That's only a prototype of what's on the way to Mars. In 2016, you have a launch going up by NASA called InSight that'll land on the Mars surface. No rover involved in that one, but it does have a big drill. It's going to drill like 15 feet to the ground, and got a seismometer that they're going to put in there and everything, all kinds of tests. That's one thing. And then during the same year, European Space Agency is going to be launching a couple of spacecraft to Mars, and they're going to be using the Russian Proton rocket to do it. We dropped it. Apparently, the weight is too much for the Ariane 5, so they must have made a deal with the Russians years ago to launch these things. One's going to be an orbital one, and then one will be a lander. It's not going to be active much on Mars for a short period of time. One in orbit will be called it's called TRACE, and that's an acronym for, studying the atmosphere, taking pictures and all, similar to some of our orbital spacecraft that's now in orbit around Mars. European Space Agency has the Mars Express that's still in orbit around Mars, so that will be joining Mars orbit for them. And then 2 years later, they have a rover that they'll be launching, EXO rover, they call it, and it's going to be launched also by the Proton rocket by Russia. And that will land on Mars, and it's going to be solar panel. It's not going to have the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generator that Curiosity has. But we will have another rover on Mars. It could last a long time, you never know. Curiosity is still going, that's over 10 years. And Opportunity is still going, and that's over 10 years. And then one more rover that will be going up will be the 2020 rover by NASA. That doesn't have a name like Curiosity, but I'm sure it will by the time it launches in 2020. And that's very similar design to Curiosity. It will probably land the same way, using the same type of system with the sky crane type of deal that they used last time. It'll drop on a cable, and then when the rover touches the ground, it'll fire pyrotechnics, and it'll be on its own. But they learned a lot from Curiosity. They'll probably have better wheels. They have wheel problems with just Curiosity, but nothing that's life-threatening for the robot. But this one has, 10 different science things on board, some of Curiosity, plus more. But one interesting one that they do have is called the MOXIE, and what it does is kind of separate the carbon dioxide in the Mars atmosphere. Now, Mars atmosphere has over 95% carbon dioxide, for an atmosphere. CW, go by. And this MOXIE gadget that's going to be on board will be the first time they try something like this. They want to be able to separate the carbon dioxide. It will separate it into oxygen and carbon monoxide. And they're going to wind up with a certain amount of grams, like 20-some odd grams or something of oxygen per hour. They plan on running this for like 50 days. And it's a prototype. The idea is eventually to have oxygen where we could breathe up there when we go up in the 2030s. NASA plans on eventually doing that using the SLS system, and Orion, the new space launch system, and the Orion spacecraft, along with a habitat module. They'll fly to Mars. They need oxygen for two reasons. You're going to need it to breathe. They'd like to have fuel, extra fuel to come back if they wanted to. One of the long-term plans is before landing on Mars with people, they'd like to send nuclear-powered, another one of these RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generator system machines to Mars, let it sit there like a factory, and put out, hundreds of times the volume that Moxie on board this 2020 rover will be doing, and eventually store up enough oxygen where they can use it to get to breathe, or maybe even subsidize that fuel for a return trip home. So a lot of exciting things coming into the future. That's pretty much it for
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout. Cancel.
That's pretty much it for that topic, and I timed out. Couple of other things. SpaceX launched two rockets recently for Asia. Put communication satellites in the geosynchronous orbit. Both launched from Florida at Launch Complex 40, which SpaceX owns outright. They launched these rockets within 3 weeks apart, which is good for SpaceX. They've been having trouble getting their rockets off the ground lately when they're supposed to. So that's a good sign. Both these rockets did not have the hydraulic legs, the landing legs that SpaceX has been testing for quite a while now on every one of their flights. The next one that will have legs will probably be in September when they launch another cargo mission to the International Space Station. The reason these two didn't have legs is because they needed enough fuel to put this thing into a geosynchronous orbit. International Space Station is only up roughly 250 miles. Geosynchronous is roughly 23,000 miles up, so it takes a lot of fuel to do that. Their plan is to eventually return all boosters to for reuse to land on land. In the future, rather than waste boosters, they'll launch a geosynchronous flight with the Falcon Heavy, they call it. That's essentially three Falcon 9s bolted together, using two of them as boosters. And the goal is to have all three come back and land on land for reuse. So that's pretty much it. You have Cygnus attached to the International Space Station. That's another cargo vessel that was launched by Antares. Both Cygnus and Antares rocket was built by Orbital Science. That's the one that launched out of Wallops Island, Virginia, and presently attached to the International Space Station. Soon to be deployed. They're going to disconnect on Earth shortly, in a couple of few days, and that will burn up over the Pacific Ocean. They don't bring stuff back like SpaceX does. That's an expendable spacecraft. So much for that. Dick, anything else? Talk about the batteries and fuses that are broken on the spacesuits that are up on the space station. Not that they're broken, but they had a couple of failures on Earth testing these things. So they'll bring up upgraded batteries and fuses on a future. Actually, the next SpaceX Dragon will bring them up because of the problem they're canceling two spacewalks that should be done within actually this month. Back to you, Dick. Any questions for me? We drop in. You can always email me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, any questions? K2RIWWSUN. For the space portion of the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm hearing for the first time, Paul, you just told me that the spacesuits have power supply and/or fuses that are failing. If I was doing a extravehicular activity outside of the space station, and that the power supply running that that backpack that's maintaining my life blows a fuse. My goodness, that doesn't sound good, because if I'm out there in one of the arms of the space station, International Space Station, it might take me 20 minutes to get back into the to the airlock. And if I had to do that with no life support, that sounds life-threatening. So run that one by again, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
And they don't want to fool with the battery system on board those things. But, you know, you read these things and they say fuse. You know, is it a fuse? Maybe it's a circuit breaker. Maybe they have a way to reset it with a command, either from Earth or maybe attached to their spacesuit. Maybe there's a button or something could push. I don't know. But I can't imagine that they have a true fuse, you know. But there is a word fuse. And they were running some tests, and one of them failed. So now they're going to try to correct this possible problem. They said, you know, all the spaces, you know, before they go up, they test this whole battery system out. They check everything, you know, they run tests. They make it space worthy. Okay, pass the test, the fuse blew, whatever it is, battery was drained properly and recharged properly. Who knows? The process of doing that is enough to maybe cause some worry that they say, you know, that, you know, it's been done once and it's maybe weakened the system, maybe weakened the circuit breaker, you know, whatever it is. I'll have to find out more technical details. This just came out. Back to you.
Yeah, that sounds somewhat worrisome. If I was an astronaut and I worried about the power supply on the life support system strapped to my back, which is continuously supplying me heat, fluid, oxygen, and so on, I wouldn't want that to fail for more than a few seconds at a time, so to speak. And I'm 20 minutes of delicate maneuvering to get back into the airlock.
Yeah, the system, by the way, Dick.
They have the, what was that again, system? PLIS system, you said?
PLIS, I'm trying to think of the acronym for PLIS. I forget what it stands for. I can find it on the computer real quick. But it's a small setup attached to their spaces in case anything fails, you know, including batteries, you know, your water supply, oxygen, failure or something, that this thing comes on and it can get you back. And then there's also a safer, they call it a safer system, that's a part of the backpack, which incorporates the PLIS system, which is, you know, in case you start floating away, it doesn't have nitrogen jets on there to get you back. It's not a real maneuvering unit that they had back in the 80s, but it does the same type of thing. They won't use it for doing work, but then they'll use it to get back in case something bad happens. They get untethered or something of that nature. So there's backups for this stuff, but I mean they don't want their primary to fail. Back to you.
This is the portable life support system, Dick. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What I was asking earlier, Paul, is that when New Horizons, which had the advantage of a much bigger booster, that's the good news, but it didn't have all of those flyby maneuvers with Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. The Voyager had a whole bunch of flyby boosts of orbital energy, or just call it energy, velocity. Therefore, what I'm really asking is, at the time that Voyager passed the 39th astronomical unit, the approximate radius of Pluto, and when New Horizons passes by the 39th astronomical unit, when it really passes by Pluto, which one passes by with higher velocity? If New Horizons passes by with higher velocity, that means although it's going to take a zillion years, eventually in total range from Earth or from the Sun, New Horizons will eventually overtake Voyager as the fastest, most distant object made by mankind. So I was asking, do you have a guess as to when it passes the approximate distance of Pluto, which of those two spacecraft do you think had the greater velocity? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, both Voyagers have greater velocity at that point. Roughly 8,000 miles per hour difference. Give you an idea, Voyager's going almost 40,000 miles per hour. Per hour. Which is amazing, you know, to think that the diameter of the Earth is 8,000, so, you know. I mean, they're tearing through space, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's not Star Trek, but 40,000 miles every hour. So, this New Horizon is 8,000 miles slower at that point. When it'll be out there in that area, the velocity of the two voyages really haven't changed much, probably since the last encounters. Of the planet Voyager. The Voyager 1's last encounter was Saturn, and actually the moon Titan. And then Voyager 2 made it to Uranus and then Neptune. Got to see the moon Triton up close. Fantastic pictures. Find them on the computer. I have old books, pictures of that moon. Incredible geysers coming off of it. Black geysers. Back to you, Dick.
I vaguely remember that one of the Voyagers had a partial lockup of a camera where it couldn't be swung in azimuth or elevation quite the time they wanted it to. And they had to do a compensating maneuver because of that. Am I confusing? But I think that was one of the Voyagers. Did have a partial camera lockup on one of its gimballing systems. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, the whole gimballing system quit, and rather than take a chance, they were trying to, you know, unlock it. It was getting, when they were getting close to, you know, for a rendezvous of the first planets, Jupiter and then Saturn, they decided to just leave the lock on both of them. And designed the, you know, when it passed, it designed it where the spacecraft would just rotate slightly, ever so slightly, to you know, stop any possible blurriness that you would get. So they figured this out exactly. I mean, you got to give these guys a lot of credit to do that. And that's what they did on those. And that's still locked to this day. So it really caused no problem. And based on that technology, they said, you know what, let's do the same thing with New Horizons. We're not even going to put anything that's going to gimbal or move on this. We're not going to have an articulated platform that's going to move. Let's keep it simple and blast this thing off to Pluto. It was originally going to be called Pluto Express. You might remember that decades ago, but they finally called it, they gave it a real name. New Horizon, and it was shot off by our biggest rocket, Atlas V, and the only one that was ever launched with five booster rockets attached to it. That's the most that you can put on an Atlas V rocket. A lot of them launched with two or three. I think Curiosity was four. I think went off with five, so it went like a bat out of hell. No rendezvous with any planets back either.
That was going to be my next question. I thought I remembered that New Horizons did not do any flybys, no rendezvous. So it got no gravity boost. James Webb telescope, that infrared telescope that's going to be launched. I think the original launch date was 2016. I think it's now been pushed off to 2018. And that's going to be considerably larger in aperture than Hubble, in a considerably more desirable location than Hubble, and looking into the far infrared, which has a lot of, that wavelength has a lot of penetration of dust clouds, So we're going to be looking into the center of galaxies and looking at those supermassive black holes that are probably at every single galactic center. So, refresh my memory, is it true that that was 2016 original launch date, but it's been pushed off to 2018? And let's hope that that date is holding. I'm really looking forward to that one. A very ambitious maneuver to go a million miles beyond the Earth on the backside in the Lagrange point number 2, I think it is, and do all of this unfolding. And Hubble has had 5 repair missions. James Webb telescope is never going to have even one repair mission. It's going really out there in no man's land. So I hope that one is on schedule. I'd much rather, though, it be another year late and be accurate rather than be early and not deployed properly. If all of that unfolding doesn't go right, boy, that's going to be a $2 billion, I think it's around a $2 billion spacecraft. Lots of money in there, a lot of capability, a lot of potential.
Repeater, time out.
And then here we go. So let me get my question here first. So any further word on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, $8 billion, to give you an idea. The new bridge that's being built, over there in over the Hudson, Tappan Zee Bridge, is a little over $2 billion. Well, this is an $8 billion project. But, it's conceived a long time ago. A lot of money has been paid out. It's roughly 10 years to put this thing together. But over 10 years, it's an $8 billion project. It's not too bad considering every space launch system flight, SLS, with an Orion on top, is going to be roughly $500 million, roughly $500 million. So it's big money when you talk about the space program. It's even bigger money when you talk about the military. It makes NASA look like, it's some kind of a sidebar. So a lot of money out there for this stuff. $8 billion. Launch date, as far as I know, was always 2018. If it was ever 2016, I don't remember ever reading that. It was 2018 to be launched by an Ariane 5 rocket, European Space Agency. That's one of their big contributions to this. They're launching it for us. And in return, we plan on giving them a lot of science back from this. As far as serviceable, let me drop it. No, it's not serviceable. They're not designing it to be serviceable. But I have read that one of the places that an Orion spacecraft could go is to the L2 location. So I don't know if they're thinking, somebody's thinking in the future that to be able to service these things. Right now you have the Gaia spacecraft out there. The Planck is just retired. Herschel's still out there. It could be that someday they're thinking about this. How are they ever going to turn a rocket around and get it back? You better bring a big, big fuel tank out there with you. Dick, over to you. K2RIW, WS2N.
I'm in, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
KC2WGV. To put it in perspective, the Manhattan Project from start to finish was $2 billion in those days, which equates to $20 billion today. So you're mentioning those prices, and look at where we're reaching. I think they're doing a great job for the amount of money that's being spent, but just gives you an idea of the complications involved.
Yep. We're aiming high, aiming for the stars, literally. Go ahead, Rich, into EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, maybe an obvious question, I don't know. Who was James Webb, or is James Webb?
I think he was one of the NASA administrators, and he might have been the NASA administrator during the Apollo mission. But the guy who's going to straighten us all out on that is Paul, WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
He was one of the first, but he was one of the guys he really pushed for the whole deal, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. He was involved with the politics behind it, trying to get this thing done. And, being so instrumental in that, they decided to, name this thing after him. So, which is rightly so, I've read some stories about this guy. He was terrific. He taught guys into, politicians and everything into doing the right thing. Back to you, Dick.
Now, when you mentioned the, it's a Russian craft called Moxie, which is going to be taking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere of Mars, separating it, giving us oxygen. And that would suggest that it's a good experiment, something that's nice to do, but the real reason for doing that is either sustaining life of an astronaut on Mars and or supplying the oxygen for fuel, which would suggest that we're still in the talking phase of sending a man to Mars. And boy, am I skeptical about that. I think every single high school student is dreaming about the fact that maybe his generation will see an astronaut on the surface of Mars. And you compare it to the Apollo lunar landing of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. Certainly an exciting prospect in 1969, in June or July, I guess it was. But because getting to Mars is at least 100 times more difficult and maybe 100 times more expensive and maybe 100 times more risky, so the chances of surviving are so much lower, the price to get there is so much higher, and what does a human being on Mars supply that curiosity, spirit, opportunity, and all these other craft, which can make measurements for years on end? What in the world can a human being supply when you put a human being on the coldest, driest place with no atmosphere, tremendous X-ray and cosmic ray continuous exposure, a couple of years in space, and all of the life support systems have to be running perfectly for...
Repeater, timeout.
All those life support systems for all of those astronauts have to be... running perfectly for something like 3 years to do this, and to put a human being into a sardine can for a couple of years, I don't really think you want to do that. So it's nice for students to dream about it, but it's my personal belief this is not a reality. Am I too negative on this one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, the flight to and from Mars won't be in a sardine can. Volume-wise, the Orion spacecraft, four people have. It's not as big as my living room, but it's pretty close volume-wise because you're floating around in there. So, roughly 16.5 feet diameter. Yeah, it gets bigger than my living room, and then. They're going to be attached to a habitat module, which is going to be about, it looks like on diagrams, it's probably about 10 times that distance. You're going to have it looks like about two connected modules, probably each one about, 20 feet long, good for 500-day flights. That's what it'll be designed for. So everything that they're doing, look at the low-density supersonic decelerator that they test, that big flying saucer thing, which will have probably a 28-foot diameter capability as it comes through the Mars atmosphere with equipment and maybe people on board. They're designing for 2030 time frame, not 2030, maybe 2035 or something. First launch of Orion is this year. Let me drop it. It will be unmanned. It will go out almost 4,000 miles, come back at 4 hours to orbit, and they'll be testing that thing out. It's not going to be launched by the ESLS. It will be launched by a Delta Heavy. It should be an interesting launch from Florida. The next flight of the SLS will be 2017. Again, another unmanned flight, but everything put together. Orion spacecraft with the all the jettison capability. It's going to go around the moon, bring it back, and then the first manned flight will probably be 2020. Maybe as late as 2021, they'll have a couple of flights to maybe bring back some stuff from an asteroid. That's planned probably for 2024. And then after that, they got nothing left to do. They could do some moon shots. Maybe go out to L2 to do something. But I mean, their goal is to get to Mars. You watch 2035 is my guess, Dick, back here.
Dick, Rich, K2 UPS has a comment.
Okay, let's Mr. Rich. And wow, as usual, Rich, are you in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, or New Jersey? K2 UPS, K2 RIW, K2 UPS Mobile, K2 RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Good evening to the net. I just came through Breezewood, Pennsylvania, heading east towards New York. But I had two questions for Paul, or you guys, anybody's listening, if they have any more information on two different projects that the U.S. had been working on. I think it was back in the 50s, two different types of propulsion for rockets when they were seriously trying to, you know, get people up there and distant places. One was going to be like a 15, the rocket was going to be the size of a 15-story building and use a series of nuclear bombs being expelled out the back end to propel this thing, similar to a Coke machine would dispense cans. As a matter of fact, they even consulted the Coca-Cola engineers to get some ideas about how they might go about this. That never came to fruition, obviously, but there was another one, too, where they just used a raw nuclear reactor as a jet to propel this thing. And they tested one upside down in the desert for a long time. They even let it go critical and explode. And I just wonder if Paul has any info on that. Back to that.
Wow. Amazing sounding projects. WS2N, K2RW. Go ahead, Paul.
The nuclear rocket, and it would have launched from Earth. It would have had enough thrust to do that. That was always on the drawing boards up until around when Reagan got in, and they canceled that. By that time, the public was so anti-nuclear, there was no way that was going to happen. But with the Star Wars thing, I know he wanted to propel things with some kind of blast coming out of the back of the spacecraft, part of his Star Wars system. Of course, that never happened. Maybe that's what you're thinking about. But something in the 50s, you said. I don't know. I don't know about that. But, we're working on ion flights, propulsion, and the Planetary Society is trying to do one of these. They're going to have a solar sail go up in about a year, I think next year, 2015, launched by SpaceX on a flight by them, and we'll see how that works out. They've done it before. Russians launched one for them, but they said it was successful, but I didn't read much about it. We'll see how this one goes. But nuclear power, I think, is pretty much out. You might take a nuclear power up there and create electricity to create an ion drive. I think that's the one that drawing boards back either.
But in the direction that Rich is asking us the question, K2UPS, I think there's been one or two space flights of an ionic engine. How well did that work? How long did it work? How much thrust did we get out of it? And
did we ever fly a solar sail? This is sort of Caroline's question, the 8.5-year-old lady who asked that question earlier tonight. Have we ever flown a solar sail? And to your knowledge, was that successful? WS2N, K2LIW.
Solar sail, they said, was successful, launched by the Planetary Society, a smaller one than what they're going to launch next year. And it was launched by, they took a ride on one of the Russian rockets. You know, there's always space on board, so it was a flight just for them. But now SpaceX will put it up there for them next year. And it's supposed to be a little bit bigger, but it's not going to be going into planetary. They're going to use it. They wanted to see if they could change the, you know, the orbit, the inclination a little bit, just with the power of the of photons in this thing. You know, is it going to be the ions and electrons coming off the sun? I don't know. They say it's going to be the photons. So that's it. And then the first question I forgot. Back to
yeah, the first question was around an ionic engine. How successful, how long a blast have we ever made with an ionic engine? However, when it comes to photon energy, or when it comes to solar wind, I think there was a proposal that the Kepler, which lost its inertial wheels, was going to go back into an operation, a stage two operation, by using panels on the end of its solar cells, on its solar panels, by moving panels out at the perimeter, and by using the variation of solar wind, it was going to do orientation. I seem to remember that James Webb is also going to be doing some solar orientation. So, have we done solar orientation? You said we did. We did fly a solar sail. I wonder how long and how much real thrust we get out of it. And what's the longest we've ever used an ionic engine? Any of the above, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Well, the solar sail was by the Planetary Society, launched by the Russians. And the same group, Planetary Society, will launch it next year by SpaceX. Dawn, that thing, visited two asteroids, Vista, and it's on the way to Cirrus. Not in orbit around that yet until next year. But I mean, it was in orbit around Vista for a year or something, and then it left that orbit, and it's done all of that with ion engine, ion capability. And that spacecraft is very successful. It has solar panels to create the electricity that they need to run the ion engine. So, and then there was one before that. What was the name of that one? I'll think of it. Deep Space One or something like that. That was a test one. But Dawn has three ion engines on board, and they don't come on at the same time. One will come on, and then another one will come on. You know, to get out of these places, they would run them like years at a time. Not months, years. Just never shut them off. Back to you.
So are you saying that the ion engine had a finite life, and there was more than one on board, and they were used sequentially? Is that what I just heard you say, you pulled that?
Yeah, they would run three, you know, there's three of them, and they would use one, and then I guess, they wear and tear, I guess they shut that one down, put another one on, and eventually come back to it. No, it wasn't dead. It didn't have a finite life. They would just shut it down and then use another one.
And earlier you told us the Voyager does its orientation. By the way, the antenna, the 8.5-foot diameter parabolic dish on Voyager, running at 8.5 gigahertz, maybe it's a 10-foot dish, but in that order, it's got less than 1 degree of beam width. I think it's around 3/4 of a degree of beam width. So therefore, you want to steer it to plus or minus 0.2 degree and aim it at Earth in order to be able to talk to that spacecraft, in order to be able to hear it. The uplink is easy. The downlink is a hard one. And I'd like to believe that most of that orientation is done with inertial wheels. I'd rather not have them open and closing reaction control jet engines that many zillions of times per year, because there's only a finite number of times you can operate those valves before you're going to get leakage of the valve. So I'd like to believe that the majority of the orientation is done with an inertial wheel, and then periodically you unwind the inertial wheel by simultaneously turning it in the other direction or slowing it down, so to speak, while you're using the reaction control jets. WS2N, K2LIW.
I know the dead man system that they have where they don't want this thing to move one way or the other for years at a time. It's pretty good. I mean, once in a while, it might get a little, you know, there might be a little turn in there, and they'll give it a tiny, tiny blast. And they might not have to give it a blast for, you know, another 6 months or a year or something. Like, when we're trying to test and figure out, are we in interstellar space or not, they would turn the Voyager. Like I said, we didn't have the capability of a moving platform anymore, so what they would do is they wanted to turn the plasma detector one way, you know, run a test. They would do that. We'd like put your finger out which way is the solar wind coming from, that type of deal. They would take the measurements, and then they would turn it back. That would they would use the solar, momentum wheels for. It does have gyros on board, too, as well. But whether or not they turn them on or turn them off, I don't know. That's pretty much it. I know the antenna has a hole in it, right in the middle. It goes right behind that. They have something that looks back to our star and picks up the light from the star. Since the so far away, and the star and the Earth is pretty much close together as far as the antenna is concerned. That's good enough. But it's right, the hole's right in the middle of the big antenna. Back to you.
So I think you're saying, Paul, that the majority of the aiming of the antenna is done by optical means. You've chosen one or two, maybe even three stars that have to line up in a particular manner that confirms the orientation of the craft, which in turn confirms that the dish is aimed at Earth. Even though Earth itself is going around the sun and continuously moving, however, when you're 128 and almost 129 astronomical units away, and the sun is moving one astronomical unit, I'm going to do that calculation. My gut feels it's like a 3 or 4 degrees back and forth the Earth is moving from the Voyager's point of view, and it's using a 3/4 degree beam with antenna. So its aiming has to follow the motion of the Earth. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know, but how often do they make transmissions back and forth? It's not daily. Sometimes weekly or bi-weekly. And then data is stored, believe it or not, on a digital 8-track recorder. They only have one on board. You think they would have had like a backup, but that thing's still working. So every couple of weeks they need a transmission to come back. So I guess they know where, you know, at that time if it's pointing in the right direction. If it's not, they'll adjust for that. They know the distance from the frequency you know, that they're sending out. They've got two bands that they use, the X band, 8.4, I think, gig. And then they had an S band, but they haven't used that since the last planet visits. They don't use the S band at all anymore. That was usually health and welfare of the spacecraft, but that's all changed. In fact, Paul Westwick's going to run out of time. This is WS2X.
Yeah, Earth moves back and forth one astronomical unit, 128 astronomical units away. That means the peak deflection of the Earth from Voyager's point of view is peak of 0.9 degree. And the beam width of the antenna is around 0.7 degree. So you've got to aim it to the nearest 0.2 degree. So they literally have to follow the Earth. Okay. I know we're running a little late tonight. Wes, N2XJN, I hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz. N2XJN, K2RIW. John, I know that you keep track because you have quite a number of QSOs with John Wes during the week, and I am guessing that Wes is still in the process of purchasing or acquiring more test equipment, more shielding devices, and probably trying to also acquire the service manuals or the operating manuals for some of his very elaborate pieces of test equipment. A bunch of guesses on my part. Am I even close, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick. He's still acquiring. Has nothing, all of the equipment that he has to get in operating status, he has not achieved that yet, but he is working on that. I know he sent you a diagram about a bifurcated coil winding that he wanted to ask questions about, but like last week, I don't know what happened to him tonight.
Yeah, we do keep him waiting a lot longer than we should. Roughly how long ago was that thing sent to me? I spent today searching high and low for which cable. I mean, I watched the guy with the telescope. I'm standing on the ground watching the telescope as they installed this beautiful antenna, a collinear 2-meter antenna, way up on my tower. And I watched the installation. I watched them connected to an ice cable. But unfortunately, there's 39 cables coming down my tower of various diameters. And where that cable went for the last 3 weeks, I didn't know. And today I finally decided to really dig down. Look at all the cables that went underground from the tower to the house. Look at all the cables that went into the shed. Look at all the cables everywhere. And I finally found that cable. And it took a heroic effort. And that cable was buried in a place where the end of the cable was buried in a place that I never suspected, where you would never find it unless what I literally had done is count the number of cables that went into a cable tray and count the cables that came back out of the other end of the cable tray, and the number didn't add up. It's very similar to what happens with that lady. Let me drop. There's a lady who has for years hung out at airports, and from time to time she finds a way, without purchasing a ticket, of getting on an airliner. And how they sometimes discover her is that they know how many tickets they collected of the people that have got on board, and as they land at the destination, they count noses, and they found out there's one extra nose. And they started asking questions, and they found out there was a stowaway. They found somebody's on board without a ticket. And for the second or third time, this lady got arrested. Well, in my case, the number of cables going in and out of the tray didn't add up. I finally started digging down in the tray, and there it was. Connected a piece of electronics to it, got a whopping big signal. I said, wow, boy, have I been looking for you. So, can you imagine, John, having the problem with so damn many antennas on your tower that when somebody connects up a cable, you can't find the other end of the cable? How many guys would like to have that problem? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'd like to have that problem, but I'd be sure I'd have them all identified because I'm anal that way. But it's good you found it. And do you have that up and working now? Are you using it?
That's what you're listening to.
Okay. I gotta see if I can hear you. I don't know.
Yeah, what? That's what you're listening to, and you can tell now that the electrons I issue have got a lot more steam behind them than they used to have, John. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I can't hear you on the input, but yeah, you sounded good.
I have a quick question, if I may.
Okay, with a quick question, Rich. Go ahead.
I think the repeater is going to go off in a minute, but anyway, the Johnson Space Flight Center, why do they sometimes call it the Johnson Space Flight Center? Sometimes they call it the Houston Center. Any reason for that?
Oh, yes. Okay. Houston, Texas. I've been there. Building 30 was the main control center.
for the Apollo mission, and I had a chance to actually go to one of those, that actual control room that you see. So President Johnson decided that that Space Center should be in Houston, and it was a complementary station to the Kennedy Space Center at the so-called Cape Canaveral, or the Cape Canaveral area. So Florida is a Kennedy Space Center, and Houston, Texas is Johnson. Johnson was in office at the time, or was a vice president at the time, and he managed to convince the rest of Congress that this is the right way to go, that there should be more than one center. You shouldn't have everything all grouped into Florida. Very similar to what happened to the B-1B bomber. The B-1B bomber was very controversial until Congress got real smart and made sure that almost every single congressional district got some of the work of some of the subcontracting of building the parts for that airplane. And all of a sudden, everybody was in favor of it. Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, very interesting, very, very interesting. You know, I just, I don't know how realistic it is, but I just downloaded a movie called Marooned. Haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, I've seen that movie. It is medium good sci-fi. It's got a couple of, well, every one of the sci-fi movies, even the Star Wars movies, if you dig deep enough and go to the right websites of YouTube videos, you go to YouTube videos and you look for scientific errors of science fiction movies. They've all got them. They've all exceeded the laws of physics somewhere. And The Marooned does exceed quite a few pieces of physics. It's a fun movie, but you will find portions where it's an error. Okay, this was TechNet number 1516 of the series. And assuming that John and I and Paul stay healthy, we'll be back next week, and we'll settle some more of these things. And now that one more of my antennas are operating, and I can now send out stronger electrons than I used to, life's getting a little bit better. And there's another antenna going out my tower. So I'll be putting out even more of these red electrons. Over to you, Paul. Be kind to each other, you guys. Don't take this too serious. This is a hobby. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. I hope those electrons don't get dizzy up there at that altitude, now that they're going to be so much higher, and now the family won't complain that you're interfering with the television set. By the way, did you get to watch that Titanic video I sent you?
Okay. I'm very forgetful. Did you mail me a Titanic video a week ago, a month ago, 3 months ago? You got to pin it down in time. I live in time. Time to me, and that'll tell me which pile to look at. John, go ahead.
Okay, I believe you did see it. It was, did J.P. Morgan Sink the Titanic was the title, I believe, and it was a little over a week ago, maybe 10 days.
Okay, and you sent this to me by video means. In other words, you didn't send me a physical object. You sent me some electronics over the internet. Is that true?
That's correct. I sent it to your email.
Okay, yeah, I am looking forward to that one, because I've seen some of the PBS specials on Cameron, I think is the name of the guy, or was it Ballard? Cameron or Ballard, one or the other, really found the Titanic, and quite a bit of investigation has taken place. And so if there is a label on the side where the word Titanic got put over top of the previous label, wow. And I think you're saying you saw pretty strong evidence of that. Is that true?
That's correct, Dick. I think you'd be interested in watching that if you get time. I think it's about a 40-minute video, something like that. Very well done and very well produced. I think you'll enjoy it.
Very fine. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye, you all. I'm going to go away. See you guys downrange. See you down the log. Catch you out,
Dick. Dick, enjoy. KC2WGB. Wish to thank everybody for participating in the net. And look forward to seeing you again, listening and hearing from you. KC2WGB, clear.
KC2WGB, and 2ATG.
Hey, Dave, good evening. KC2WGB.
You can't get off that easy. Yeah, I just wanted to give you some quick info regarding the nice, bright, Iridium sat. Two nights. You're the lucky man.
What are they scheduled for?
Oh, you got your pencil ready. I'll give you the details.
Senor, La Pluma Premier.
Well, we must have designed this one just for you because it's a minus 8.3 magnitude, which is as bright as they come on the 12th. So time is getting close. Night on the 12th. The time is 21:20:07:21:20:07. 54 degrees up. Due east, 85 degrees. Due east. Come. Just to know the flare. The full moon is quite bright. But the 9:20. It might be a little competition, but still, minus 8.3 is quite a sight.
Yeah, that's not quite due east. It's still right over my garage, so it's going to fall in the same area as the other lucky me. I don't think the moon will interfere with that much, but it did ruin my shower experience last night. I don't know. I'm going to go out again tonight and take another look, see if I can see any vestige of that shower.
Yeah, I got to work tomorrow morning, so I'm going to try and get some sleep. Well, this is due east. 90 degrees is directly east, and 5, so it is pretty much east. I think the other ones that you were seeing over your garage, I think those were northeast. I think those were 60 some odd degrees.
Yep, you're correct, but it's still right over my garage. Perfect.
Okay, real good. Well, enjoy. Like I said, you're the lucky one. You've got the bright one. Everybody else is like buskers.
Good to hear. I get a few lucky things once in a while. That's 21:20:07. 4 degrees by 85. Okay. Should be it.
Yeah, so tonight's going to be the 11th, so to speak. So, Tuesday night.
Roger, Dodger. And I have nothing scheduled for Tuesday night, so that should be perfect.
Yeah, hopefully the weather is going to cooperate. Check that far down. I've had this information now for about 4 or 5 days, and I'm trying to call you and give it to you so you can have it in advance.
Well, you know, you can always find me here at this time anyway. But, yeah, I've been rather busy and not on the air as much. Daytime, I'm never there. But, okay. I thank you for that info, and I'll let you get some snoozing in.
If Dick is still listening, he mentioned antenna and all that stuff. I am not hearing him direct tonight. And normally, I think he was usually on a Yagi. Usually I can hear him on the Yagi, but he really did not hear him at all on the input frequency tonight. So maybe he's running. 10 milliwatts. So.
John and Tuio.
Yeah, you know, Dick, he's trying to save a few bucks, you know. It's tough. So he might be running less than a watt. Who knows, but he's got that collinear up there, so I didn't hear him on the input either. Rich, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, waiting for the beep. No beep. John, when the repeater shuts down, would you care to go to 145.64? Or maybe 147.00 with me. And the other station, I'm going to turn it over to you, sir. You're full quieting on the on reverse. Where are you? I'm in Massapequa Park.
Yeah, we're neighbors. I'm in Massapequa. Not too far away from you. Shouldn't have too much trouble coming. I'm going to let John rest his voice. Well, he wasn't doing most of the talking tonight, but... on for a while. I'll say 7-3 to both the gentlemen and catch you again up with the thing out. And 2 APG. John, go ahead.
Okay, Dave. Thanks for the info, and we'll talk to you soon. Get some sleep, because poor guys have got to go to work. It's terrible. Rich, I have 707 up. Anytime you want to go.
Say that again, John. Where would you like to go?
7000.
Archie Roger.